This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Charleston is mourning the deaths of nine people who were shot and killed inside a historically black church on Wednesday night. A manhunt ended in North Carolina yesterday when authorities arrested 21-year-old Dylan Roff, who is white. He's been transported to Charleston. He faces several murder charges. NPR correspondent Debbie Elliott has been following the tragedy, and she joins me now from Charleston. Debbie, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you, Frank.
You've been in Charleston for a while. You've talked with members of the community. At this moment, how are people grappling with this tragedy?
You know, I think people are still reeling at this point. There has certainly been an outpouring of love for Emmanuel AME Church, where the shooting occurred. Tonight, Charleston will come together for a community-wide prayer vigil. But today, the church itself has sort of been the center of attention. People have been walking by, bringing things. There's a makeshift memorial in front of the church. People are paying tribute. They're saying silent prayers. They're bringing flowers, notes, balloons, ribbons, all things to sort of remember the victims of this church and say, you know, we are Charleston and we stand with you. The people that I spoke with were still mostly stunned that this could happen in their community. One woman, a daycare teacher, told me she wasn't really sure how she was going to get through the day, but she knew she had to start it there and sort of be there, feel that sadness, show her love to the church. There's also a sense of anger that people don't really understand how this could have possibly not only happened in their community, but in a place of worship, a place that is supposed to be a place of refuge, a refuge, a place of peace, they said.
What do we know? Do we know more about Dylan Roff? He was formally charged this morning, the suspect in this case. What are authorities saying about what happened on Wednesday night? Do we know more?
We are not getting a whole lot more. We know he was in the church for about an hour during their prayer service and Bible study there before he opened fire. Today he will appear before a judge for a bond hearing at 2 o'clock. He has been charged with 9 counts of murder and a weapons charge, and he could face the death penalty. South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley has called for that, and now, not long ago, Mayor Joseph Riley is also weighing in. He says he's no proponent of the death penalty, but, quote, if you're going to have a death penalty, certainly this case would merit it.
This has been called a hate crime locally. At the federal level, it's being investigated as a possible hate crime. Through all of this, some conversation now again about the Confederate flag that still flies over South Carolina's Capitol building. Is that conversation in currency right now in Charleston?
You know, I had a couple of people bring it up outside of the church today in the context of an overall climate. There have been activists and civil rights groups in South Carolina who have wanted the Confederate flag taken off of the Capitol grounds, and annually they push for that and have not had success. It has been moved from the top of the Capitol to the Capitol grounds, but as one man said today, he was with the NAACP in Orangeburg, and he said that's like telling a Klansman not to wear his hood in the house, so he's holding it in his arms. So there is definitely some sentiment that this could open up the debate about that. But most people were not bringing up political issues. Most people that I spoke with were still sort of just in mourning and in shock that such a horrible thing would happen. And they were just happy that the suspect was in custody.
All right, Debbie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
NPR's Debbie Elliott from Charleston. Well, the Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church is a symbol of civil rights in the South and an African-American institution in Charleston. It was founded in the early 19th century by a former slave who lost his life in the fight for black freedom. Congregation members worked to move enslaved people north on the Underground Railroad through that church, and 20th century civil rights leaders like Martin Luther King Jr. often spoke there. The church has also been the target of arson and other acts of violence since its inception. In fact, President Obama pointed that out when he spoke yesterday about this tragedy.
This is not the first time that black churches have been attacked. And we know that hatred across races and faiths pose a particular threat to our democracy and our ideals. The good news is I am confident that the outpouring of unity and strength and fellowship and love across Charleston today, from all races, from all faiths, from all places of worship indicates the degree to which those old vestiges of hatred can be overcome.
Well, joining me now to talk about the cultural and political history of black churches in the South is Valerie Cooper. She's a professor of black church studies at Duke University. Professor Cooper, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's good to be here, although the topic is so sad. But I think talking about it will be helpful.
Well, tell us about the symbolism about African-American churches and the powerful role they've played in the liberation struggle.
I would say that black churches are the beating heart of many black communities. They are not only places of worship and theological reflection and spirituality, but they're also places of leadership development, a rich source of black music tradition, and they're also economic powerhouses. Offerings taken up on Sunday become large deposits in churches on Monday morning. In banks on Monday morning. So there are these central places. I mean, this time of year is vacation Bible school. There are kids coming from neighborhoods all across the country going to churches for instruction, for a little food, a little fellowship, a little play. They're central to so many communities.
Well, talk about the development of independent African-American churches in this country. These are Christian churches.
That's right. So the AME denomination, African Methodist Episcopal, emerged out of a racist event at a Methodist Episcopal church in Philadelphia in 1792. So this goes back quite a ways. In Philadelphia, there was a fairly large and stable free black population. They had a benevolent society, the Free African Society. They were looking after community needs. Many of the leaders were worshiping at a then integrated Methodist Episcopal Church. The Methodist Episcopal Church of then is what is now the United Methodist Church. And so there was an incident at St. George's Methodist Episcopal Church in Philadelphia where the white members of the church had decided to segregate the sanctuary and to remove blacks to a separate area. They did some renovations. Blacks participated in the renovations. And then on the first Sunday that they met after the renovations were completed, they tried to remove African-Americans who were praying at the time. After that incident at St. George's, Richard Allen decided to create a separate congregation, which ultimately becomes the first independent African-American denomination, the AME. So they kept the Methodist Episcopal part of the name. They weren't divorcing themselves from Wesleyan theology or from Methodist ways of worshiping. They were just divorcing themselves from the racism they'd experienced. They were seeking a place where they could worship with autonomy in the ways that they liked, and that they would be free from racism. And that's ultimately the story again and again of independent black churches. It's a search for a place where your humanity will be recognized and celebrated.
But the fact that African Americans would have to create their own church, their own, I emphasize, Christian church, is a scandal all by itself.
It absolutely is. So the theologian H. Richard Niebuhr notes that it's a scandal, it's a sin that we've drawn the line of caste in the Christian church. But he also notes that it's a sin that we've become so inured to, we don't even think of it as a problem. We're not even ashamed of it anymore. I'm a fifth-generation United Methodist. My mom's family in Baltimore were members of Sharp Street United Methodist Church. Sharp Street considered, in the early 19th century, becoming a part of the AME denomination and ultimately decided not to join. They hadn't completely given up on the possibility of racial integration in the church, of full citizenship. So this was a debate in black churches. This was an argument. This was a discussion in the Free African Society at a time when free blacks were being encouraged to go back to Africa. Could we be a part of the American experience? Could we be full citizens? And it is even more tragic when you think about the body of Christ, that it would be divided along these racial lines, and that the question would be, will we ever be fully included in the body of Christ? I mean, can you imagine attending a church where blacks are required to sit in a segregated section or not allowed to take communion until all the whites have been served, where the theology says that you are inferior? Of course, black churches, independent black churches emerged. because we needed places to celebrate our humanity and our relationship with God.
And this particular church, Emmanuel AME in Charleston, its history is in a sense a centerpiece and a kind of a poster example of what you're talking about. Tell us about that history.
So Emmanuel AME is, according to their own website, according to their own reporting, is the earliest AME church in the south of Baltimore, and one of the largest AME congregations in the South. It is a church that suffered tremendously because of its association with Denmark Vesey. So Vesey was planning a slave insurrection. It ultimately, the plot was discovered. And because Vesey was a member of the AME church, he, the pastor, Morris Brown, and many others were suspected. Brown fled. Vesey was executed, as were a number of other members of the church. And then the church was burned down. So there have been periods when the members of Emmanuel had to go underground to worship. That also has a long tradition in African-American history, the tradition of worshiping in the hush harbors, in the private places, to escape either slave owners or those who hate blacks or wanted to somehow circumscribe black worship.
We're talking to Valerie Cooper, a professor of black church studies at Duke University, and our conversation will continue on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, today talking about the history of advocacy at Southern black churches in the wake of Wednesday night shooting at Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston. My guest is Valerie Cooper, a professor of black church studies at Duke University, and we're talking about the particular church, Emmanuel AME, and its position in the civil rights movement. As you said, it was burned down a couple of times precisely because it was a black church. Talk about the current iteration, because it was important in the 20th century civil rights movement as well, right?
Well, so let's contextualize this in the broader South. For many Southern towns, the church building was the only architecture that the black community owned and had free access to. They weren't permitted in other civic auditoria or, you know, other places. And so the black church was the building. It could house a number of people. You could go to the education building or the sanctuary. And so labor organizing, other political organizing that would otherwise happen in other places, in other communities, always happened in the black church. So our identification of the civil rights movement with black churches has a lot to do with the fact that the folks doing the legwork, the people distributing flyers about the Montgomery bus boycott, were the church ladies who had run them off in church basements on old mimeograph machines, right? They were people who had networks of associations and networks of trust because of their association with black churches. So it's not just the leaders. We think immediately of people like Martin King, but it's also, you know, the on-the-ground workers. So there's been this history of violence against black churches as a means of derailing political organizing, educational outreach, as a means of intimidating. I mean, so I can't think of this event at Emmanuel as anything but a terrorist act. It was meant to terrorize. And there's a long, bloody, very sad history of bombings and arson. One thinks of 16th Street Baptist Church in 1963, the four little girls who died. A long history of violence against black churches as a means of attacking black communities, as a means of destabilizing black communities and disrupting the organization that's happening there.
And remember, what terrorism is violence against a civilian, against noncombatants, to, in a sense, hold fearful the rest of the population. And that's the point of terrorism. That's why Leon Klinghoffer, a man in a wheelchair, gets pushed overboard by the terrorist who took over the Achille Lauro, to show people that we are that ruthless. And so if you kill little girls in a church basement, you are telling people we are that ruthless. And it's in the service of white supremacy. So,
yes.
So the use of the word terrorism in this case is completely appropriate. It's trying to hold fearful a population by showing
yes.
a ruthless use of violence against noncombatants.
That's right. And that's why it's so troubling that some in the media in particular have hesitated to use that term. To me, it's perfectly appropriate. My response to the events at Emmanuel are incredible sadness and anger and grief, when I think about the role that Black churches have played in my own life, in terms of developing me as a person and people who invested in me and loved me, I've also been thinking about the term sanctuary, right? It derived from a Latin root, holy. It's a holy place. But it has a secondary meaning, a place of safety, place of refuge. Your reporter mentioned this in the lead, in the introduction. That's been defiled, and it is horribly perverse. It is the nature of a terrorist act to do something that is beyond the pale. But when you think about what the intention is, what we are to fear, it feels like open season on Black people.
Well, that's sort of another question, is whether or not, I'm sure we're going to hear much about the mental stability of the suspect as this case moves forward. But there's also another conversation to be had about a kind of condition of permissiveness around the white police officers shooting Black men and holding guns to white girls' heads. The idea that these very few of these have been punished and even prosecuted can lead to a conversation, or does it, in some communities, that there's a kind of permission that's granted when these aren't properly prosecuted.
I would put this in the context of extrajudicial killings, and many of them are, frankly, lynchings, right? So for most of the 20th century, we couldn't get anti-lynching law through Congress. Southern senators kept filibustering it. They kept saying they needed that violence to control their Negro populations. In the context of, you know, the killings of people like Tamir Rice and other unarmed young Black men, the fact that nobody's paying any price for this, there are no legal consequences, suggests that Black lives really do not matter, right? So it's terribly frightening. I think that on some level we are reaping hatred that's been sown in public media, Facebook, places like that. Ever since the election of President Barack Obama, there's been a kind of heightened racial animus that's been let loose. You know, people were triumphing that we'd reached in a post-racial age. No, what's happened instead is that racism has become more apparent, more obvious, easier to hear and see.
Well, and talk about the language, too, that we use to describe this, and the way racism has become normalized in the United States. And you've done an analysis of the way newspapers talked about lynching. And again, the kind of discrepancy in the way we treat foreign terrorists. When they kill us, we send drones abroad and kill who knows who, but at least maybe we get a guy. And that's okay, but we don't seem to react with the same ferocity for this kind of violence. And you found evidence of that even in the way we report it.
So we, as a nation, have a terrible case of historical amnesia. We don't remember our own story, and we're always surprised when someone else brings it up. So a few weeks ago, the New York Times did a series on lynching, and it was noted that they never discussed the race of the people doing the lynching. They would talk about the race of the people being lynched as though they lynched themselves, right? There's a kind of a discomfort and awkwardness about dealing with race. And particularly in the church, there's a hesitation to deal with the theological connotations of the white supremacy that's embedded in much of our theology. Two of my wonderful colleagues, J. Cameron Carter and Willie Jennings at Duke University, are doing wonderful work on this, uncovering the ways that theology enabled missionizing, but also the slave trade, right? We had a political and an economic motivation, and we came up with a theology to explain it. And we haven't ever undone the deep roots of that white supremacist theology. You know, the churches run after all sorts of sins, that we're angry about so many things, but there doesn't seem to be much anger about racism as a sin against God.
Yeah, that raises the question. I mean, it raises a question about why African Americans would start Christian churches, having been subjugated by them, and various passages repeated over and over again that in the service of slavery and Jim Crow. That's the one question. But the bigger question now is, how are the churches losing some of their influence because they don't seem? Is there a perception that they're not places that can be effective against this kind of thing?
So, in the early 20th century, Howard Thurman, a theologian, he was the dean of the chapel at Howard University for many years and founded an integrated congregation, went to Ceylon, then Sri Lanka, and was asked by a Hindu, how can you be a Christian? You're betraying all people of color everywhere in the world. And this person, this Hindu, read a litany of crimes against black people. And Thurman argued, I'm a Christian because I've understood who Jesus was. He was an oppressed minority in an empire, the Roman Empire. And I understand Christianity, Thurman said, as the story of the man with his back against the wall. So Thurman's answer to this question would be that African Americans got a hold of what authentic Christianity was, no matter how people tried to adulterate it. And it is clear, looking at our history, whether or not you believe in God, that these institutions that we call churches have been powerful motivators and places of safety and institution builders in black communities. So the second part of your question, is the black church as effective as it ever was? So two wonderful scholars, Eddie Glaude at Princeton and Yosef Soret at Columbia, argued this. Is the black church dead? And, you know, it was a great conversation worth looking up on, worth Googling. So the black church doesn't have the institutional power, the kind of hegemony that it had in the Jim Crow era. People can go wherever they would like, in the same way that historically black colleges now have to compete for students that they would have ordinarily received quite usually. There's been lots of discussion lately about the rise of the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, people who have no religious affiliation. Lots of conversation about this in churches of all races and colors. And it's a great question. I don't actually think in terms of the macro about this. I think about the, you know, storefront church that's doing yeoman's work, right? They may not have everyone in the neighborhood in their church on Sunday mornings, but the whole neighborhood is impacted by the feeding program they do, or the Bible study that doubles as a reading program, right? Or the care that they're giving to ex-inmates. And so, you know, whether or not American churches, black, white, Hispanic, Asian, are as powerful as they ever were, probably not. But the response to this shooting says to me that black churches are still central, something important, not only to black people. There are whites and others coming to lay tributes and flowers because of what this church symbolizes.
Professor Cooper, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Valerie Cooper is a professor of black church studies at Duke University.